Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The NALM program is the National Animal Health Laboratory Network, and that's a network of over 60 animal health diagnostic laboratories, and they really are a critical first line of defense because they are the folks who will receive samples from veterinarians and be able to quickly tell if it's a really serious disease like foot and mouth disease or if it's a less serious disease.
Talking about the National Animal Health Laboratory Network, Dr. Julie Wallens with USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection.
So the NALM network, or National Animal Health Laboratory Network, adds to our nation's preparedness for animal disease outbreaks by providing that first line of being able to detect where the disease is and where it isn't and allow us to quickly contain it.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So let's actually play a little bit of a game here. Estimated deficit reduction for 2023. If you actually were just to take on obesity-related illnesses this fiscal year, so we're using current math, $283 billion.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert on the debt, the budget, and obesity.
Okay, but remember, the Democrats' tax proposal, the president's tax proposal was, hey, we're going to go from 37% to 39% for top earners. Okay, stagnant number. None of these are dynamically scored on the effects on the economy, because if you made people healthier on this side, the economy would grow. When you raise people's taxes, the economy shrinks. But the stagnant number is $30 billion. So let's see, just obesity-related spending will be $283 billion this fiscal year to the taxpayers. And the Democrats, the president's tax hike, produces $30 billion. Did anyone see the insanity here? So we basically did the math for everyone, saying if Democrats would have to increase the top tax rate to 62% to raise the same amount of money as getting rid of obesity for people on government programs. Okay, that's uncomfortable to talk about, but think about that. You'd basically have to raise the top tax rate to 62% just to produce the revenues, receipts, for this population here. It's a different way. I'm struggling just trying to find a creative way to get people to think about that the path of having a healthier America is both moral and it's great economics. So let's try it another way. Estimated deficit reduction for fiscal year 24 to 33. So that functionally that 9 fiscal years. We expect federal spending on severe, this is severe obesity, not the mainstream, to be $1,724 billion. And if anyone wants to see this report, once it's officially voted on, then it's report, this will be on the Republican side of the Joint Economic Committee, Chapter 3. Read it. It's brilliant. $1,724 billion over functionally that 10-year cycle. Just for severely obese populations on try, and these are for Medicare, Medicaid, Indian Health Services, veterans, on taking care of our brothers and sisters because the illnesses that come with this. You would have to increase the top tax rate to 49% to raise the same amount of money as getting rid of severe, we're not talking obesity, just the severe obesity. Remember last week I brought the charts on how it's rated. One disease that we are told that of the 4,000 human conditions, illnesses, misery, half of them are related to obesity. Are we willing to talk about it as we do the farm legislation? Are we willing to talk about it with some of the new technologies, and I'm going to touch on these, that are available to us? Are we willing to talk about it just on what's happening, on how much of prime-age working males are not in the labor force, and the number one thing we're seeing actually isn't substance abuse. It's close. It's actually health-related to obesity.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The plan's actually the important part of it, right?
Brian Lubers is a Kansas State livestock veterinarian on having a plan for death in livestock.
What we usually find is, you know, that scenario happens where someone walks out, they have a dead animal, and there is no plan, right? And there's actually, nobody ever wants to see that, right? And so, but there are some things I think we can get out of that situation that having the plan will help us do a better job. And so really the first thing is that animal provides us the opportunity to get some information. So what was the cause of that mortality? Was it an infectious disease where now I'm worried about other members of my herd? Is it kind of a one-off thing? You know, what exactly happened? And so the first part of that plan is how to kind of do the necropsy. And I encourage people, you know, we often think that, well, we have to call the veterinarian out to come and do a necropsy. And yes, that can happen, but it's also possible to train producers to do their own necropsies too. And really what we're trying to do with those is catch more information so the veterinarian's not available, especially in the summertime. If you can't get a veterinarian out very quickly, decomposition happens very. And so it becomes, if you can't get somebody out in a matter of hours or so, it may not be worth it to try to do much with. And what I always encourage people to do is take lots of pictures, right? And so take pictures before you move the animal so the veterinarian's able to kind of see what environment it died in. And then we can teach a very simple, basic necropsy that people can do in 20 minutes or so, plus or minus, and take pictures as you go along, right? And depending on what you see as you kind of do that necropsy, there may be some cases where a veterinarian would say, you know, this might be one where we want to take some samples. If we suspect it's a toxicity, again, if we suspect there's some infectious diseases going on, there might be different types of samples to collect to kind of help us narrow down. And really, I make a big deal about the necropsy because typically what happens is if we don't have the plan, we don't do the necropsy, we lose all that information. And then lo and behold, another one happens a couple weeks later. And the question always is, are those two animal mortalities related? And if we've already started that process, we're gathering information from day one, we're just that much further ahead of the curve.
What happens in instances of multiple deaths?
The level of criticalness kind of goes up, right, when we have those mass events. And again, we can still see the same causes. It could be, you know, we see individual animals that die from lightning strike, and we see group mortality events, right? We see the same with heat. We see the same with infectious diseases. We can see the same with toxicity. So the number may help us think about certain causes is more or less likely, but even then, that information is still just as important. Now, as far as doing a necropsy on a larger number of animals, probably not necessary. If it's all seems to be related, we can probably pick one or two, maybe three representative animals to do the testing and sampling on. But then we get into, you know, the difference at that point becomes some of our disposal options, right? And so if it's one animal, we kind of go maybe down one path as far as disposal. But if we have these mass events where animals have died off, then there's different set of regulations that come into play. The recommended disposal methods are a little bit different. And in Kansas, you know, we fall under regulations by the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. And they actually, their order of preference is to render first. So that's the first option, depending on how many animals you have. And then composting, landfill disposal, on-site burial, and then incineration is kind of the last option. And there's pluses and minuses to all of those.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm speaking with Brian Jennings, CEO of the American Coalition for Ethanol, as we wrapped up the 2023 annual conference here in Minneapolis. And Brian, how do you think it went?
Oh, I'm so pleased. I think we had a bigger crowd than we've had in the past. It's nice to have the pandemic in the rearview mirror, and a lot of people showed up. So a lot of enthusiasm, I think a lot of interest in figuring out what kind of technologies these plants want to invest in. So it was a great event.
Well, you talked about the policy issues right now that you're facing. Really, not as many as we have had in the past, and they seem like almost like I don't want to call it minutiae, but it's like something that just has to be done. But they're doing it right now, like E15, for example. But where do we stand as far as the governor's petition? That's really the big issue right now that EPA is dragging their feet on.
It's absolutely the biggest issue because the governor's way back in 2022 said, look, we'd like to do this. They provided the scientific data to EPA to justify allowing E15 year-round in their states. And EPA, while they took too long to put out the proposal, EPA agreed with them that you're right. If we allowed you to use E15 year-round, emissions are going to be better in your state. So now we're just at a point where, okay, EPA, why don't you just have the final say, make the final determination? And that's where the frustration lies because the terminals are telling us, the refiners are telling us, the sooner the final outcome is known, the quicker we can kind of gear up to prepare for the 2024 summer driving season. I'll be honest with you, Cindy, I think some of those concerns are more perceived than real, but let's just get this done. EPA is way overdue, and so thank goodness the state leadership has been so tremendous. Thank goodness the attorneys general for Iowa and Nebraska have, you know, gone for it. It's unfortunate, I guess, that they've had to sue EPA, but they're, you know, calling EPA on the carpet here. We've drawn this to the attention of the president, but it's in EPA's court now, and they've got to get a final rule out soon.
The other issue that we're facing right now is the opportunity, and that's under the IRA and the incentives that are out there under the IRA that we're still waiting on, finding out how to do. And that's really something you can't wait for.
It isn't. And it's a whole new world. I mean, we've spent so many years cultivating relationships, and I don't know how effective that's been, right? But engaging EPA over various rulemakings, annual rulemakings. This is a whole new ballgame where Treasury is in charge at this stage. Congress asked Treasury to carry out tax credits. That's how it works. So we need the rules to the road for 45Z. 45Q, which is carbon capture and sequestration, was on the books previous to the IRA. So plants and the Summit Carbon Solutions of the world generally have an idea for how that's going to work. But this new clean fuel production tax credit could be very generous for producers. Upwards of the equivalent, we've done the math, the equivalent is about a $262 per ton CO2 price. And so if you can drop your carbon intensity by a few meaningful points within an ethanol facility through technology you add to reduce natural gas use or, right, to acquire lower carbon feedstocks. Maybe it's corn that's being delivered to your facility from a farmer that engages in some of these so-called climate smart practices. You could get a great big tax credit, but we don't know the rules to the road. We don't know how granular Treasury is going to be able to get in terms of carbon intensity. We don't know a whole lot about the table that they have to put out on an annual basis. The thing we know, which is good, is that Congress requires Treasury to use GREET and the latest science, life cycle science on this, so that's a benefit. But there are more questions than answers at this stage, Cindy, about the, we think, opportunities from 45Z.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Let's see if I can make myself a complete pariah around here from telling the truth on the map.
Could changes to the farm bill, especially through nutrition, help fix obesity issues in our country and therefore the debt? Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
Estimated deficit reduction for 2023. Projected federal spending on severe obesity. This is just that very top threshold. This budget year will be $115 billion. And this is, once again, just in Medicare, Medicaid, Indian Health Services, veterans. Democrats would have to raise the top tax rate to 47% just to raise the amount of money just this population costs. Am I at least making a point here that the discussion saying, just raise taxes, that takes care of it? Because remember, the last 12 months, what do we borrow per second over the last 12 months? $63,000 every second is what we've borrowed over the last 12 months. Okay, one more of these. Estimated deficit reduction between 24 and 33. Estimated deficit reduction, projected federal spending on all obesity-related illnesses. Now, remember, this is a static number. There's also, we estimate, about another $1.5 trillion that you would gain in productivity because these populations can actually come back and participate in the society. But over that time, it's over $4 trillion is what our government will spend. Now add another half of it, $1.5 trillion on the economic vitality you gain. You would actually have to have a marginal tax rate for the top earners in this country of 65% to come close to covering that cost. And that's for one illness. Now, it's the illness that is the most expensive in our society because it's related into diabetes and kidney failure and heart attacks and everything else. But am I sort of making the point? Because we're seeing over $4 trillion just in the disease, and the Biden tax proposal produces $375 billion over the 10 years. For those of you who are not really good at math, $375 billion is a hell of a lot less than $4 trillion. And this is the lunacy here, where the theater is so much more important than the reality of the math. So let's actually walk through this. Joint Economic Committee Republicans estimate the cost of obesity over the 10 years. So the 10 years we're about to start the budget cycle on is $5.6 trillion. If you want to start to stabilize debt to GDP, can we at least have a conversation about this? When you start to see the mortality statistics in this country, the number of working age people, people who should be actually living their lives, who are dying, and they're dying early. I'm going to show you a chart and a little bit of our young people and what's going on there. The game of avoiding this discussion needs to come to an end because the economics and the morality of it are here. So let's pull our heads out. Let's actually time to actually have that difficult conversation.
This is Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There's definitely some supply side support.
Dr. Glenn Tonser, K-State livestock economist.
Cattle and feed report got broken down in the last series and so forth. Not major surprises in my perspective there, but just reiterating the number of hooves in the system is and will continue to tighten. And we're going to talk demand here in a minute, but it continues to shine the light on the price mover is going to be on the demand side because I think there's growing certainty on the tight cattle supply part of that equation.
Tonser looks at boxed beef.
So choice Friday was 318. This is USDA's boxed beef cutout quotes versus 316 the week before. So that's a $2 improvement in choice beef. Select was 293 on Friday, up almost $5 from the week before. So we are seeing a little bit of a near-term boost there. It would be nice to see there be some additional legs. You know, we are still in grilling season. You know, we're past some of the key holidays, but roughly a year ago, one of your predecessors and I did a long segment on the impact of tailgating and grilling on meat demand and so forth. Putting a shout out to that for people who can pull it up and listen to it. You know, hopefully K-State's about ready to go on a, you know, multi-win football streak. And, you know, all our listeners, we have a purple bias group, but more generally college football, high school football, so forth, is getting ready to kick off. To the extent that boost, you know, interesting grilling, that's worth watching. And we'll see if it pulls those cutout values up with it. There's seasonal patterns, like grilling is fairly seasonal. You know, I don't want to get into weather arguments about if it goes on longer in the year than others and so forth. But the part that is atypical this year is, you know, the sort of post-pandemic meat demand effects, and certainly the post-pandemic and the cattle cycle and the drought-induced supply side of this. Both of them are fairly unique. So there's a lot of things in 2023 that you can't look for historical precedent on. But when it comes to seasonality of grilling, we certainly can look at seasonality from the past.
It also highlights some interesting health-based research.
I have the privilege of working with a lot of great students, and Justin Bina is one of them. Justin led and helped me kick out a special report using meat demand monitor data here, primarily for 2023, looking at the interaction or the relationship between protein consumption and your physical fitness. So how active you are, do you have goals for weightlifting and ongoing anaerobic exercise and so forth? And a couple of nuggets that are in there, and again, you can pull the full report up on our Ag Manager website, is over a third people say yes to the following question. Do you intentionally eat protein to aid in meeting strength training or other fitness-related goals? The relevance of that over a third saying yes is they are way more likely to include beef or pork in their meals yesterday. Specifically, if you said yes to that, you had 0.86 meals yesterday that included beef. So we asked if you had beef in your breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So less, you know, not quite one meal a day if you said yes, but it's 0.6 meals. So a lot closer to half a meal a day if you said no. And I know that sounds like silly small numbers, but remember, we're a country of over 300 million people. So scale these things up. It's a really big deal. Pork is 0.56 if you say yes. So a little over half a meal yesterday that included pork if you said yes to that protein question or intentionality of protein consumption. And it's less than half. It's 0.45 if you said no. And we geek out on that a lot more than that in the report. There's regional patterns. The western states and the southern states are more likely to say this is an intentional part of why they buy protein. All else equal, if you're younger, it's more there. And actually, it's more likely in most age cohorts for males than females. So all of that helps us further understand what's the role of some growing interest in personal fitness goals. COVID magnified that. It's already kind of there, but it ramped it up. And I think it's important for the beef and pork industries to track that. Justin's special report using MDM data gives us another fresh look at that. My last shout out there, I'm purposely using his name because I want to give him credit for this. But his dissertation is underway over the next 6, 9, maybe 12 months. We're going to get a lot more detail on this topic using not just MDM data, but some other broader federal data sets at the end of the day to help the stakeholders understand that what's the role of personal fitness and goals on meat demand.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm speaking with Ron Lamberty, the Chief Marketing Officer for the American Coalition for Ethanol. We just wrapped up your annual conference, and how do you think it went?
It went well. We had a good turnout, about, you know, quite a bit more people than we had the last time. And it was kind of fun because we had some people that I haven't seen for a while that were on our panels, and I think it went, from everything everybody's told us, I think they enjoyed it.
Well, I want you to talk about your retailer panel, something you've been doing for, you know, a decade or so, but let's talk about the guys that were on the panel today.
I was a retailer, so I know that what, you know, there's a lot of time spent in some places where they're trying to figure out what would work for retailers. You can really shortcut that time frame if you just go ask them. So we've always worked directly with retailers, and our strategy has been to find a retailer in a market, get them to sell the fuel, and then hopefully irritate enough of the competitors that they'll all have to go along or just get their butts kicked in the marketplace. So, you know, what we do with this panel each year is we pick a couple of retailers that have done pretty well, and we just get them up there, and they can talk about the things they've done. And the two we selected this time, one of them had been on there a long time ago, and he's gone from doing about 300,000 gallons of gas with ethanol in it to where he's doing, in that same location, 1.4 million. And then he's also doing millions and millions more of transportation because he ended up, you know, going to get his own E98 and blending his own fuel and selling that to others and all of these different things that he's doing that have made him huge. And he got the attention by being the ethanol guy sort of in his area. The other one is Glenn Badenhop, and that was Bruce Vollen in Baltic, South Dakota. But the other one's Glenn Badenhop from Ohio. And he's basically was here because he's had to fight, you know, his branded oil company in all kinds of different ways. He was one of the first E15 retailers in the U.S., and he's also one of the most recent because he started doing it when he was independent. He went branded, and they told him he couldn't do it, so he had to move it off under the canopy. And now he went to sign his new contract and told him he's not going to do it unless they let him do E15, and they did. So they both had great stories, and it's good for people to understand that, you know, we can put all the programs we want together, we can pass all the laws, but the retailers, the guys who own those stations, are the ones who have to decide they're going to sell our product, and they're going to have to promote it for us. So I always like to bring those guys in as a reminder of this is who does our probably the most important part of our work is to make it available to consumers and to promote it to them.
And you know, we recognize these retailers, ACE does, with the Paul Dana Marketing Award, named after someone that probably a lot of people still don't remember at this point. We have so many young people in there, they probably don't remember Paul.
Yeah, I thought about that this morning, and like right after I gave the award, you know, Brian yesterday when he did the Merle Anderson Award said, how many people you know who Merle Anderson is? Well, Paul Dana was an IndyCar driver, and he was the guy that got the industry to come together to, you know, sponsor a vehicle and then sponsor a car in the race team, and it got the IndyCar Racing League to switch over to ethanol powered fuel. And he was a great promoter, and he had vision. So we call it the Paul Dana Marketing Vision Award, and that's what we, you know, so it's not always a retailer that gets the award, it's somebody who did something to help us expand retail sales of ethanol. But this year it was Glenn, because like I said, he's duked it out. He hasn't, you know, he doesn't do as much volume as a lot of other people do, but he does a lot lot more of some products, and those are ethanol products. And he's also helped us by going to Capitol Hill whenever we need somebody from the real world to talk to elected officials and say, no, this is what it's really like to sell ethanol in the marketplace. And no, I don't have people coming back and saying they got problems. I don't have issues with my equipment. And so he's been a great real-world source for us. And then part of, you know, a group of people that I contact fairly frequently just find out if something's going on that I haven't heard about yet.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
A late summer decline in our nation's pasture and rangeland conditions, per USDA's latest report.
37% of the nation's rangeland and pastures rated good to excellent on the 20th of August, down 3 percentage points from a week ago, and 35% very poor to poor, and is up 3 points from last week.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey breaks down the opposite ends of the condition rating spectrum, starting with the dry side.
Texas leads the nation 77% very poor to poor. Other states that are at or above 50% include Washington State as well as Louisiana. A couple of Midwestern states still coming in above 40%, Minnesota, Missouri.
And where to find pastures in good to excellent condition?
Parts of the Central Plains and adjacent Rockies still looking very green as we finish off summer. As you move into the east where it's been a bit wetter, we do see quite a few numbers above 70% in states like Tennessee, Alabama, and Florida.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.